Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Marvin Gowron and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, guys.
Hey,
good
Paula.
Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Marvin.
Sorry if I panicked you.
No, I wasn't panicked.
Hey, this is Cosmic Citizen webcasting. What could go wrong?
Yeah, Chris Lapine and his family are here at my house.
Are you kidding me?
No, and they his mother is turning 100 today. And here for her 100th birthday party. And they stayed with us last night, and we got up this morning, and Chris and I were just engaged in a very deep conversation. I turned around and it was like 2 minutes to 10. I went, oh my God, Chris,
I know how that goes.
and
with Chris, I can imagine you got in a lot of words edgewise too.
Well, of course, and we, you know, you guys know we're old friends. Chris has been a part. Chris has actually been on the show, and he's such a dyed-in-the-wool evangelist. And so it's not hard for him and I to get into a conversation that is very engrossing.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah. No, Chris. Chris is a good talker too. Once you get him going.
He is. And a good thinker, so.
Oh, yeah, he's a good thinker, there's no question, but he's a good talker.
He's a good listener, too.
So, thanks for indulging me.
Yes, he can be.
The minute I came running up to the computer and Marvin called, "Are you coming?" I'm like, yes, I'll be on in just a moment. So normally we like to have a few minutes to talk before the show starts, but I was remiss. I made it, though.
Well, we're good.
I know. Good.
Don't worry. There's nothing that's happened in the world this past week, so there really wasn't anything to talk about.
It
has been an intense time, hasn't it?
It has been intense. No doubt about it.
And
surrealistic. I don't know if you guys feel like I do, but I really didn't think that this would happen. I just didn't see it happening. And here it is.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I do see the possibility of it happening, given the fact that, you know, Russia has taken the lean toward autocracy under Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have virtually absolute power within your country, what is there really to stop your mind from going to all the things that you could do if only you would? And
yeah,
that's the unfortunate thing. We in our country, we at least have, you know, checks and balances, even though those are under attack, you know, but the fact is we have them. There's no check and balance. They've just gotten rid of any journalistic enterprises that are saying anything against the invasion. You know, so not even the Fourth Estate is functioning in Russia. Far from it. The legislature is in Putin's pocket, and so this is what you get when one man can make whatever decision he wants. Period.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
There are so many themes from our revelation that are playing out in this current situation. I mean, we've touched on this passage so many times because it seems so relevant to our peculiar juncture, you know, in history. And it's the one on this, it's become known as the interregnum quote, you know, because the word interregnum, which is such an interesting word, only occurs once in the entire text of the Urantia book, and it's in this paragraph, so it makes it very easy to find. But they're talking time. Yeah, they're talking about time and material evolution and how slow that can be at periods in the world's development. And then there are periods where material development outruns spiritual development or wisdom, and especially among leadership. And then you have these situations where civilization and its forward march is threatened, really. Its forward momentum is seriously jeopardized. And this paragraph is a wonderful description of it. If you guys don't mind, I'll just throw it out there as context for our conversation. Yeah. The slowness of it, it's 118.86. It'll be familiar to many of us. The slowness of evolution, of human cultural progress, testifies to the effectiveness of that break. Material inertia, brake meaning like brakes on a car, material inertia which so efficiently operates to retard dangerous velocities of progress. Thus does time itself cushion and distribute the otherwise lethal results of premature escape from the next encompassing barriers to human action. And here's the key section. In the middle of the paragraph, for when culture advances over fast, and then they describe what they mean by that, when material achievement outruns the evolution of worship wisdom. Talk about a pregnant phrase, right?
Mm-hmm.
When material achievement outruns the evolution of worship wisdom, then does civilization contain within itself the seeds of retrogression? And unless buttressed by the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, such human societies will recede from high but premature levels of attainment, and the, quote, dark ages, unquote, of the interregnum of wisdom, sort of the in-between time between wisdom and lack of wisdom, the dark ages of the interregnum of wisdom will bear witness to the inexorable restoration of the imbalance between self-liberty and self-control. So I want to make some comments here, and we're all three of us. Chuck is going to be joining us in upcoming weeks. He's got other stuff happening, and all three of us, we're trying not to become politically partisan, but you know, there's so much political stuff flying around in these situations. But we're trying to speak generically and around values that are explicated in this revelation and how they're playing out in this situation that's unfolding geopolitically in the world with the, you know, to put it in context, the Ukrainian war that's happening with Russia invading Ukraine. And so much is at play in this situation that's described in these paragraphs. I want to take just a few phrases. The swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, and we'll see in the section we're going to read on the social value of war, I think it's social value of war, right? Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Section two.
The social, it has so much that is like happening as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be interesting to read it. But, you know, we can look at this as specifically what's happening between these two countries, right? Ukraine and Russia in Europe. And we can also expand the frame of reference and look at what's going on geopolitically in the evolution of civilization on our world, right? At this very critical stage. You know, we've had two world wars in the last 100 years, major conflagrations between groups, substantial groups of nations, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not such a battle. This is not yet, and we hope it won't be, a world war, right, where groups of nations band together and battle each other as constellations of nations in a worldwide struggle. This is still an intense but a local battle. But look at what's happening. In the last 100 years, technology, material progress, has dramatically shot forward. I mean, we have technologies now with computerization, largely, that really have eclipsed anything we've had before in our ability to wage war and to act collectively. That, to me, is the key term, as humanity, to act collectively and to act globally. And here you have a situation where there is one leader in the world, and there are other situations that bear a resemblance, but it's happening now in Russia, who is motivated, and there's nothing subtle about this, so I don't have to couch my terms, motivated dramatically by intense nationalism, an intense patriotic nationalism for the history and the perpetuation and expansion of Russian nationalism. And there are no innocent actors here. This is happening in every country in the world, right? Is nationalism is a powerful and alive force, and we are struggling with it. But here, a leader who has untrammeled power, who has, through real brutality, created a situation where he is a dictator, an autocracy, and has made the decision to extend the nationalistic intentions brutally and violently against a neighbor. But what is going on in the global situation is this struggle that's described in this paragraph between worship wisdom, I think, you know, between leadership that has a spiritual dimension that's guiding it, and wisdom. And, you know, it's interesting to look at people's experience. Both Putin and Biden here have decades of leadership accumulated wisdom. They've been in these positions for many decades. And you see the clash of visions and the clash of values unfolding. And It would not be difficult for many countries to band together and go into world war. I mean, we're that's what's so gripping.
That's
about
what's so scary.
It's so scary, and
yeah.
we could move across that threshold very easily and very quickly if mistakes are made in leadership at this juncture, and the stakes are incredibly high. Because of nuclear armaments,
right?
We have the ability in literally in seconds to destroy civilization to such an extent that we could be thrown back into an era of barbarism in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's in the balance here. And you look at the way leadership is reacting, and you look at the way the opposition globally has been organized and coordinated, and with what values that drive it and that are being articulated. And it is a battle for men's souls. And it is, you know, I think it's a critical juncture in geopolitical evolution. And we are either going to fail in this attempt and take a substantial backward step in that evolutionary progress, or we have the opportunity to consolidate and take a dramatic forward step in the development of global structures for coordination and worship wisdom to play out. And it's happening now in these weeks. And so I'm sorry to sort of go on at some length, but I just think this is such a historically pregnant time. It has so much happening so quickly. And I think we'll look back historically and recognize that this has been quite a critical juncture in the forward march of civilization. And either we'll step up and succeed in how we deal with it, or we will fail and regress. So anyways, those are some thoughts, and I don't know what you guys think about it.
Well, you know.
Well, they're good thoughts. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead,
and,
Paul.
And you've rightly assessed the situation, I think, Marvin, in terms of its danger to humanity. Worship wisdom, I hear Chuck, you know, he would key in on that, worship-wisdom. And it's interesting, the last two adjectives are worship and then wisdom, right? We would naturally think wisdom or worship would be the highest, but no, wisdom is, and worship leads to wisdom. You know, trying to think like God, be like God, lead you
well,
to be wise.
The phrase, unless buttressed by the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, that means buttressed by worship. Sorry about that.
Right. And, you know, people are praying like crazy. I mean, I'm praying every day. I'm praying for, you know, the strength of humanity to deal with this. And only people can really solve this problem. You know, I'm curious about the immediate wish to assign blame to, well, if only they hadn't done that, then that wouldn't have happened, and then this wouldn't have happened, and those things are all great in retrospect to see where we all fell short, right, to help create the situation. But right now, the Ukrainians are in dire need. They're, you know, they're suffering. And, you know, it occurred to me last week in thinking about this that I can't, you know, my heart can't be at ease as long as I know that this is going on in the world. And I felt the same way about Syria. I felt this about Yemen, about, you know, every terrible thing that happens on this world, because we are all together. We're in this field together. And those disturbances, the disturbance to one causes a disturbance for all. We can't escape that. That's the lesson of the part and the whole, right? But I'm going to share a paragraph that gives me great comfort. And this is from paper 143. These are the words of Jesus. Paper 143, section 1, paragraph 4. He says, I have come into this world to do the will of my Father and to reveal his loving character to all mankind. That, my brethren, is my mission. And this one thing I will do, regardless of the misunderstanding of my teachings by Jews or Gentiles of this day or of another generation. But you should not overlook the fact that even divine love has its severe disciplines. A father's love for his son oftentimes impels the father to restrain the unwise acts of his thoughtless offspring. Child does not always comprehend the wise and loving motives of the father's restraining discipline. But I declare to you that my Father in paradise does rule a universe of universes by the compelling power of his love love is the greatest of all spirit realities. Truth is a liberating revelation, but love is the supreme relationship. And no matter what blunders your fellow men make in their world management of today, in an age to come, the gospel which I declare to you will rule this very world. The ultimate goal of human progress is the reverent recognition of the fatherhood of God and the loving materialization, brotherhood, of man. You know, to me, that's a promise. And I know, I have faith, that is true. I believe him. He will. The words he spoke at that moment will rule this very world. They will. And I have ultimate faith in the Father's love and in love in general to overcome all of these difficulties, if only we will start to use that great power that we all have, the power of love. And, you know, certainly right now that we're not seeing that play out in the world. And, you know, that speaks to no matter what blunders your fellow men make in their world management of today, you know, certainly he foresaw all of that. And I also remember him saying, you know, speaking of when he would return and stuff, he said, I've come to make a beginning of setting these things right. But many ages will be required to restore this part of the universe to former paths. Many ages. He's only been gone for 2,000 years and some. And what many ages means, I'm not sure. But I also know that this world has been in rebellion for a very, very long time. And it seems to me that it's coming to a head. Just, you know, I just have that feeling that this, you know, you're right, Marvin, this is coming to a very crucial head where we are faced with the choice. It's a very simple choice. What do we choose?
Mm-hmm.
Peace, love, and brotherhood, or war and destruction? And I think this section we're about to read really explores that, the value
yes.
of war, but, you know, it goes on to say it doesn't have much value anymore, folks. You're trying to get rid of this. This tool isn't going to serve you anymore. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, there's a very powerful set of macro values that are playing out here in this situation. I mean, if you believe what Jesus articulated in that passage you just read, the way you function is every human being is my sister or brother. We have a common spiritual parent. We must love each other and learn to resolve our problems, our issues, our differences peacefully and respectfully and find mutually acceptable solutions as we move forward. And we must learn to do that in larger parts of the whole, right?
Right.
Until eventually what they tell us is we must do that as a world, right, as a globe where all humanity functions in that way, where we care more about each other than our own selfish good and ends. And we act graciously and altruistically for the well-being of the whole, right?
Right.
That's what flows from Jesus' gospel. With God as sovereign,
mm-hmm.
We love each other. We treat each other the way we wish to be treated. No one in any situation wants to have another individual come into their territory and club them to death, right? So that's not the golden rule. So
No. What's
playing out in our world is this simple choice. Do groups mm-hmm. of human beings act consonantly with the values of the gospel, or do they act frankly out of Luciferian motivation, you know, of my way will prevail. Yeah, and my way will prevail, and I will move forward irrespective of what the whole, the aggregate, feels is wise and et cetera. What I find particularly fascinating is that the world right now in the last few weeks and going forward has a choice to use old solutions or to develop new solutions that are progressive and lead to what the book says must happen if we are to move through this stage of civilization. We must form a global culture and society that has global mechanisms for coordination,
right,
and adjudication of differences.
Right, and a global representative government.
Exactly.
A global representative government.
We have these nascent structures that are inadequate to the task currently. But what's happening is, which is very interesting, as far as I understand, this is the first time in global history that the large majority of the nations are being effectively led and coordinated in a concerted and united effort to place not warfare pressure, but essentially economic and political pressure,
yeah,
in a coordinated fashion to, in a sense, on the fly and informally, legislate and execute, right? Two of the three branches. Reach a conclusion and then coordinate and execute action to curb a wayward in the global community, put pressure, and establish order and control guided by higher values to reestablish peace and forward momentum in civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's the first time that has been attempted, and there are global mechanisms that are evolving informally that I think, in retrospect, will be understood historically and incorporated into an emerging world order. And if it happens well and we learn the lessons well, we will see that when the global community acts in concert and with wise leadership, it can actually manage to resolve a situation forcefully in execution by means other than warfare. And that's an by coordination and by consensus. And so those are the values that are playing out on the global stage very intensively as we speak. You know, will that succeed? And what will happen not only in the next few weeks, but in the next few months and years in this equation that is moving very, very rapidly? So it's,
yeah,
you know, the values you cited in that paragraph are in play. But they're played very practically and geopolitically. It's a critical stage, I think. And we're facing the same challenge in climate arenas and in economic arenas. How do we more thoroughly coordinate for the well-being of the whole? That's the issue. And prevent solitary actors who are motivated by short-sighted and self-centered motivations from becoming bad actors and violent actors on the global scene. That's what's at play. Yeah.
Well, Andre, you wanted to make a comment too. Or you should, before we start to read, you should be able to weigh in on this conversation.
I don't need to make much comment. I agree with what Marvin's saying. It's clear that we're at a juncture. The real question is, you know, our ability to get to a place that is somehow works for everyone, and what are we willing to do as compromise move? Clearly, one of the moves is we're willing to go ahead and funnel all kinds of humanitarian aid and arms into the Ukraine, but we're not willing to go ahead and protect them directly for fear, and this is the bind we've gotten ourselves into, for fear of the calculus of mutually assured destruction, or MAD, as some of us remember, this having been made into an acronym, which of course it is, the idea that you have enough nuclear weapons that either side could annihilate the other, and that a first strike would not be sufficient to prevent the other from also destroying you. Therefore, with sane actors on the stage, you are not going to have people firing off nuclear weapons at each other.
Right.
But that proviso of sane actors is quite a proviso, because, you know, we have three main nuclear powers in the world. We actually have a few other minor nuclear powers that are also there, and anyone starting anything could set off, essentially tip over a domino that gets all the other dominoes to fall just because of reaction capacity. And we actually have, you can look this up in Wikipedia, and I'll go ahead and I'll post this in the chat later. There was that famous incident in the late 70s or early 1980s where there was a false echo or some kind of false indication to the Russians that we had launched a first strike against them. And it was only as a result of one colonel, or
one
I
man.
Believe it was a colonel.
Yeah, a Russian.
One man.
Who didn't do it.
Who did not react, that we did not spark, you know, a nuclear war. Now, we've been clearly protected to some extent by, you know, our celestial friends, brothers, sisters, you know, that are working overtime to make sure that anything like this does not happen inadvertently. But they are not empowered to override human will to the extent that it ever becomes collectively an indication that we really want to go forward with such a crazy enterprise as launching a nuclear war. So, I mean, we've seen in our history that they allowed two nuclear weapons to be dropped on Japan. They didn't intervene there. And you can argue back and forth all you want, but this is a very dangerous state of affairs. But that very dangerous state of affairs is something that I've been reflecting on, you know, since this has been talked about the last week and more, has been the idea that this mutually assured destruction, this calculus that is there, is now acting effectively as something that can be used as a pawn in the game, basically, for anybody who's willing to appear crazy enough. It's sort of like the crazy spouse in a marriage, you know, the man or the woman who knows that they can get whatever they want by having a tantrum, or the child, you know, and that's what we're experiencing right now. And we require an evolution of, speaking of, this worship wisdom. What is the experiential wisdom that is going to evolve, that's going to allow us to see what the correct course of action is? Because right now, we're not willing to put in a no-fly zone over the Ukraine to prevent these people from being essentially wantonly slaughtered by the Russians at will, okay? We're not putting in a no-fly zone because of the potential that could cause an inadvertent conflict, you know, inadvertent or desired conflict. And if that happens, that just the fear of doing that is preventing us from being able to do anything. And this underscores the need for world government.
So let's take a step back. Let's prognosticate a little bit, okay? And you framed it nicely, Andre, about this threat of nuclear war, this big chip on the table, you know, in this high-stakes gamble. So what's going on is Putin has played that threat. You know, he said, let everyone be forewarned, we're a nuclear power and we will react.
We're on alert.
And the West and the rest of the world is basically saying, we will not do a no-fly zone. We will not engage in the possibility of direct confrontation with this player. We have to allow this to play out, but we will act with great coordination and fierce effect to accomplish an end result not in the near term, but in the intermediate term, that will rectify this situation. And hear me out. They're not going to do a no-fly zone. They're going to have to sit and live with the destruction in Ukraine and maybe the occupation and control of Ukraine, the decapitation of their government in the short term. In the intermediate term, there is being brought to bear an unprecedented level of coordination economically to basically bring Russia down to a level where it is impotent and in dramatic recession, to where it cannot function with a military or in any other way. In other words, there's a warfare unfolding. It's just not with direct and immediate violent means on the world end. Mm-hmm. And what may happen in the next few years is Russia is incapable of functioning as a nation anymore and must give up its aims for hegemony, you know, for conquest of Ukraine, and that the Ukrainians resist, and that they eventually lose, and it will be done without any of the other countries firing a shot, and only as a result of major coordination on the part of the global community. That could happen.
Mm-hmm.
They could lose in the next year or so because they're so decimated by these other coordinated means that they have to surrender because they're not capable of fighting anymore. They're in such a shambles. And the lesson that will be learned is no solitary actor is powerful enough to withstand the coordinated, wisely led leadership of the global community. The global community will win without firing a shot in a global war. That's a huge development in the forward march of civilization and may lead to consensus building structures much more formally and something that goes beyond the League of Nations, the United Nations, and actually begins to establish the basis for government, legislative, executive, and judicial function. That could happen out of this, which would be a much better result than ecological disaster or a true global war. That could happen in this situation if we learn our lessons and apply them well. And so far, I think we are, actually.
It takes
great wisdom and great discipline to keep from wading into a direct war.
And some people think we've already reacted too much, that we've already goaded him into doing what he's doing now. But, Pam on the board asks, you know, is there anything we can do to help him save face? I don't know if there is or not. But I posted, and it's from the papers coming up. It's foreshadowing, I guess. This statement is coming up in Section 3 of Paper 70. It says, the peace of Urantia will be promoted far more by international trade organizations. And this goes to your point, Marvin, than by all the sentimental sophistry of visionary peace planning. Trade relations have been facilitated by development of language and by improved methods of communication. Well, we've got that.
Yeah.
As well as by better transportation. So, you know, these economics, you know, strategies do take time. Duperrey's comment also on the board, and we have to bear the pain of watching a sovereign nation be pummeled, and we have the power to do, you know, a no-fly zone and all of these things, but there is a madman with his hand on the button, and none of us could say for sure that he won't push it.
Right.
None of us. And this is the dicey, you know, when our world leaders can't even say, oh, you know, he won't push that button. We thought for a while he wouldn't invade in Ukraine, but he proved that we were wrong there. And
I think in the short term, meaning weeks and months, he will prevail.
Yeah.
And
I
think
agree.
In the intermediate frame, in months, in the next year or two, I think he will fail royally. And it will be very clear that the Russian economy and the Russian national infrastructure is beginning to collapse, and it will collapse quite fully to where they can't get anything they need to perpetuate their military venture or to perpetuate right. any of the core functions of their society. There are already large numbers of Russian people who see the writing on the wall and are trying desperately to get out of the country. Because I think it's going to be very instructive what happens as a result of the organization and marshaling of this new kind of weaponry, which can only function by virtue of the mobilization of a true global community to act in the face of such aggression.
Right.
And that's never happened before.
And I'll add one more mm-hmm. piece to that, Marvin, and that is if we can get over our addiction to oil, you know,
yeah.
the world, if we're willing to make that sacrifice and willing to say, look, we don't need to go there that bad. We don't need to drive these extra miles. We can learn to live within, a budget of oil. We won't be as free as we have been. But
mark my words here, Paula. In the next 2 years, just watch. See what happens in Europe in terms of the dramatic escalation of the shift away from fossil fuels to alternate forms of energy, right?
And maybe
not even gas, but watch them out of duress in this situation and fear. Watch them develop solar, electrical, nuclear, et cetera, all these other
right.
things to the point where the shift that we need to make on the ecological side happens much more quickly because of what's happening with this situation. These things are interlocked,
point.
You know?
That's true.
So mm-hmm. we're facing multiple crises that can only be resolved by global coordination. And you know, the ante is up
mm-hmm.
in this situation
mm-hmm.
on all fronts, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good points. Well, shall we start to read The Social Value
yes.
of War? Because it's, you know, obviously, I mean, I just shared a little foreshadowing from Section 3. This paper is not always what it seems to be, but it's so insightful and so invaluable. So we should read Section 2. Marvin, would you? Yeah, go ahead, read that for us.
Yeah. So this is Paper 70, The Evolution of Human Government, and it's Section 2, which is entitled The Social Value of War. What a challenging title for a section.
Yes, for this moment in time, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In past ages, a fierce war would institute social changes and facilitate the adoption of new ideas such as would not have occurred naturally in 10,000 years. Wow. You know, talk about what we've been talking about here, right? The terrible price paid for these certain war advantages was that society was temporarily thrown back into savagery. Civilized reason had to abdicate. And that's what's happening in Ukraine right now.
Mm-hmm.
War is strong medicine. Very costly and most dangerous. While often curative of certain social disorders, it sometimes kills the patient, destroys the society. So we'll have to come back. We'll have lots of conversation about these things.
I know.
The constant necessity for national defense creates many new and advanced social adjustments. Society today enjoys the benefit of a long list of useful innovations which were at first wholly military, and it is even indebted to war for the dance, one of the early forms of which was a military drill. War has had a social value to past civilizations because it, and then here's a list of five items, because it, one, imposed discipline, enforced cooperation. And so it's interesting to ask yourself, how are each of these five playing out in the current situation and providing a social value for our civilization? So one, it imposed discipline, enforced cooperation. Well, okay, I'll I'll restrain myself because there's so much we could say. We'll come back. Two, put a premium on fortitude and courage, fostered and solidified nationalism. Four, destroyed weak and unfit peoples. This is how it had value in the past. Five, dissolve the illusion of primitive equality and selectively stratified society. War has had a certain evolutionary and selective value, but like slavery, it must sometime be abandoned as civilization slowly advances. Olden wars promoted travel and cultural intercourse. These ends are now better served by modern methods of transport and communication. Olden wars strengthen nations, but modern struggles disrupt civilized culture. Ancient warfare resulted in the decimation of inferior peoples. The net result of modern conflict is the selective destruction of the best human stocks. Early wars promoted organization and efficiency, but these have now become the aims of modern industry. During past ages, war was a social ferment which pushed civilization forward. This result is now better attained by ambition and invention. Ancient warfare supported the concept of a god of battles, but modern man has been told that God is love. War has served many valuable purposes in the past. It has been an indispensable scaffolding in the building of civilization, but it is rapidly becoming culturally bankrupt, incapable of producing dividends of social gain in any way commensurate with the terrible losses attendant upon its invocation.
I want to throw in here just a reminder that this was written probably in 1933, before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So keep going, Martin.
Yeah, and of course the Midwayers and other, you know, celestials here on the planet could foresee the building of forces that would result in something like the Second World War and the development of nuclear armamentation. So they could see ahead a certain portion.
It was written by Melchizedek too, by the way, this section.
Uh-huh.
Or this paper.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Emergency celestials, mm-hmm. you know, but often leading mm-hmm. in emergencies. At one time, physicians believed in bloodletting as a cure for many diseases, but they have since discovered better remedies for most of these disorders. And so must the international bloodletting of war certainly give place to the discovery of better methods for curing the ills of nations. The nations of Eurasia have already entered upon the gigantic struggle between nationalistic militarism and industrialism. Wow. And mm-hmm. in many ways, this conflict is analogous to the age-long struggle between the herder-hunter and the farmer. But if industrialism is to triumph over militarism, it must avoid the dangers which beset it. The perils of budding industry on Urantia are, and here's a list of six. One, the strong drift toward materialism, spiritual blindness. Two, the worship of wealth, power, value distortion. Three, the vices of luxury, cultural immaturity. Four, the increasing dangers of indolence, service insensitivity. Five, the growth of undesirable racial softness, biologic deterioration. Six, the threat of standardized industrial slavery, personality stagnation. Labor is ennobling, but drudgery is benumbing. Interesting phrase, the threat of standardized industrial slavery. Militarism is autocratic and cruel, savage. It promotes social organization among the conquerors, but disintegrates the vanquished. Industrialism is more civilized and should be so carried on as to promote initiative and to encourage individualism. Society should in every way possible foster originality. That's interesting. You know, we see a plethora of books that talk about organizational innovation, creative, pockets within organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Do not make the mistake of glorifying war. Rather, discern what it has done for society so that you may the more accurately visualize what its substitutes must provide in order to continue the advancement of civilization. And if such adequate substitutes are not provided, then you may be sure that war will long continue. Man will never accept peace as a normal mode of living. Excuse me, just a sec. Man will never accept peace as a normal mode of living until he has been thoroughly and repeatedly convinced that peace is best for his material welfare. And until society has wisely provided peaceful substitutes for the gratification of an inherent tendency periodically to let loose a collective drive designed to liberate those ever-accumulating emotions and energies belonging to the self-preservation reactions of the human species. But even in passing, war should be honored as the school of experience which compelled a race of arrogant individuals to submit themselves to highly concentrated authority, a chief executive. Old-fashioned war did select the innately great men for leadership, but modern war no longer does this. To discover leaders, society must now turn to the conquests of peace, industry, science, and social achievement.
Wow.
So it's like, here's a window into, evolution. What has worked in the past no longer works. We must evolve new mechanisms. And there's so much in this section. I mean, I look at this list of the perils of budding industry, the internal to our own society, this list of six. The drift toward materialism or spiritual blindness. I mean, we see that in our cultures, right? The worship of wealth, power, value distortion. The disparity that's unfolding economically and in terms of concentration of money and power. The vices of luxury, cultural immaturity instead of the service motive. And the increasing dangers of indolence, service insensitivity. The racial stuff, I'm not sure we're going to go there without, that's an incendiary topic. But then the threat of standardized industrial slavery, that there are still substantial parts of the world where drudgery, which is benumbing, is foisted on people, while, in many pockets, wealth is accumulated to abhorrent degrees. The large groups of people function with no agency, essentially slaves to an economic disorder. So, these are the dangers that face us that are more subtle, and we have to get over them and form a different kind of society. So the question is, what is playing out here in this situation? And what's so interesting is it's playing out in a global theater that's immediate and real time. Everything is happening real time in the way of communication, which is unprecedented. So the value choices are immediate and ubiquitous all over the world. Groups of individuals and nations are making key choices. They have to, in a coordinated fashion, either to be part of this evolutionary development in dealing with the challenges, or to sit on the sidelines, which, thankfully, not many nations are doing that.
Right. Well, it seems to point out to me very clearly one solution over militarism is industrialism.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why it tells us the pitfalls of that. But it really, the Melchizedek ends this section with, but, you know, we have to get creative about this and find out how we can make this work, industrialism. Because militarism is not going to be a solution here. It's autocratic and cruel. He doesn't mince words, does he? I mean, he's straight up. And this is probably what I love the most about the Urantia book, is its straightforward way of describing the issues at hand and giving us, you know, just here it is. And in some ways, it's almost too obvious. You know, but I think, and here's just one other thought, Marvin, is that we've had relatively, since World War II, we've had, what, 80 years now of relative peace.
Yeah.
And the industrial nations of the world have thrived and prospered. In fact, we have a whole generation of young people that have never heard the term MAD that Andre mentioned just a moment ago. Mutually assured destruction. They don't even know what that means, probably. They're learning it now. All of a sudden, all of the things that we grew up with, the fear of, you know, the duck and cover drills we did as children in school, the fear of being bombed, you know, those things have, you know, there's been a relatively long period of time when those things have not happened. And the contrast between what we've just experienced, especially in Europe, Europe has thrived. Europe has thrived even more than we have, I think. And they've taken society to a new level where they care about each other. They, you know, they provide the needs of families. And I think Europe has done a beautiful job. And Europeans especially have prospered in this peace. And not to take away from other countries that haven't and have suffered, you know, horribly, like Syria, for instance. But again, there's a dictator and a despot behind that. But, you know, it's just interesting. My hope is that this contrast between this period of peace and now all of a sudden, oh, wow, yikes, this hurts. This is awful.
So
how can we allow this? This can't happen.
So look at what's happened during that 80-year period. Let's just take a step back and sort of analyze it a little bit. It's been a period of relative peace broken by some singular exceptions, right? You had Vietnam. You've had small local wars, as the Urantia book described. You had Vietnam. You had a major disaster in Iraq, which was very unfortunate. And Korea is even before then. But I'm looking at Vietnam, Iraq. Those are the two major, Afghanistan. These were misadventures that were local. And in a sense, Ukraine and Russia is something like that, but it's much more because of the alliances. But what has happened in that 80-year period is we have not had global wars, meaning groups of nations forming and battling each other as aggregations of nations. That hasn't happened in the last 80 years. So it's been relative peace, right? But what has happened in the last 80 years is industrialism has dramatically moved forward in its technologies and in its coordination. In the last 80 years, international travel by air transport has become the universal norm. 80 years ago, that wasn't the case.
Yes.
We didn't have airlines that span the globe like this. We didn't have a global information network that make real-time communication and visualization of unfolding situations immediate in everyone's living room in each moment as it unfolds. That's unprecedented. But look at what else has happened. In the last 2 weeks, as a result of major global coordination, the industries of the world have, in a coordinated fashion, isolated an unruly member and are waging war against that unruly member via industrialism. And a striking example is Taiwan, which produces the vast majority of the microchips on which the entire of society runs these days,
mm-hmm.
has joined with this sanction list and will not provide any more, and the other microchip mm-hmm. providers, the minor ones, will not provide anything to Russia anymore. So immediately, every mechanism of their society, including their military machine, will begin to degrade and deteriorate so that within a few months or years, it will be inoperable. They may want to wage war, but they are going to start breaking down very quickly in ways that cannot be remedied and replaced. And
right.
and so it's a new form of coordination and warfare that is not violent and destructive. And that is industrialism in lieu of physical warfare. So what they're describing in this section is unfolding in a dramatic new way here. Russia will lose because they will not be able to sustain any function of their society. They'll start to really crumble, and it's already begun, because all of what's necessary for the functioning of a modern state is suddenly and dramatically being withdrawn, and they can't persist. They won't be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to
they
be a very, very powerful
lesson.
They can
do some damage in the
meantime. I think China is watching very carefully and learning mm-hmm. very powerful lessons. And
that's
I don't think
point.
They're going to be tempted to take on, attempt to militarily occupy Taiwan, because they know that the same thing could happen to them. And it would be more devastating for them because they're such an export economy. So industrialism is conquering militarism in as we speak, I think.
Yeah, I agree. But it's a hard road.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, and he spells it out. He says, but if industrialism is to triumph over materialism or militarism, it must avoid the dangers which beset it. And
mm-hmm.
here they are. And then he gives that list, right, of the dangers,
mm-hmm.
the strong drift
mm-hmm.
towards materialism and spiritual blindness. Well, you know, we see that. The worship of wealth, power, value distortion, man, we totally see that. You know, and it's interesting because these things have gotten worse since he wrote this. You know, this was a warning in the 1930s. These things have started to happen a lot since then. The vices of luxury. My gosh, you know, I'm just going to give a personal example. My own parents. My dad worked. My mom did not. And she didn't have to. She later went to work part-time to make a little extra money. We had a one-car garage. We had one car. We had, you know, we had a telephone and a TV and a few things. We all lived quite happily on the $600 a month that my dad made. My mom was able to stay home and raise us and be there for us. You know, but everything changed all of a sudden. Everybody had to have another car, and, you know, and so it goes. Everybody had to have a dishwasher. Everybody had to have, you know, it's like industrialism created this demand for, you know, the vices of luxury. And we totally thought, I mean, there's probably many, 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 many things we think we have to have that we don't really have to have. And, you know, the increasing dangers of indolence, you know, laziness towards service. And I don't see that one as much. You know, nobody is capable of solving the problems of race softness. I mean, not on this world, not now. It ain't going to happen. That's, you know, you can see that genetics, you know, to build a better genetic human being is a good thing for us to consider genetics when we're considering, you know, who we're going to mate with. And those are all important, but, you know, it's just too dicey, like you said, Marvin. But then six is the threat of standardized industrial slavery. Man, we see that. You know, a lot of people in the Western world have said, no, I'm not going to buy that because that was made in a sweatshop.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know? And then there's plenty of people who say, oh, it's cheap. I am going to buy it. because I want cheap. I want stuff. I want lots of stuff, and I want it to be cheap. So who cares if it was me? At least it gave them a job. You know, you hear a lot of justification for some of this stuff. So, you know, and when you look at this, this is really about morality.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about us being able willingly to say, do I really need that? You know?
It's about values.
It's about values and being honest with ourselves. And, you know, our discussion about oil and our willingness to pay more at the pump because it matters to, you know, the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that, decisions we make and money not being the total value that has the most meaning on the planet, you know. Whether or not it costs a lot or doesn't cost him a lot, whether or not he has a lot or doesn't have a lot. You know, these are value distortions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's why I find this paper so thought-provoking. This section is incredible that way. I mean, it really makes you think, and your admonition that we keep in mind what's going on in the world right now as we read this. Yeah, you know, you can't help but see the parallels here. You just can't.
Well, you know, go ahead, Paula.
I want to say something, just in
amplification of what you're saying. You take the first sentence in this section, right? In past ages, a fierce war, which is what we have right now, right? A fierce war would institute social changes and facilitate the adoption of new ideas such as would not have occurred naturally in 10,000 years. Look at what's happening right now. We face a number of threats that are threatening to humanity as a whole. And you know, you can have different opinions about the climate and ecological situation. But nevertheless, it seems to be something, it's a challenge that is a huge global challenge that has, civilizationally lethal end result possibilities, you know, if we don't turn the corner on it. And you have this other situation where a war has broken out and the world community is being forced very painfully to act in a coordinated fashion to develop and innovate new structures and new ways of functioning that it probably would not have developed over 100 or 200, 300 years at the quickest if it was just slow and evolutionary because of the danger, right?
Yeah.
And that level of coordination and what we learn along the way, that we can develop structures and habits of interaction where we trust each other and we coordinate together as a global community, are crucial lessons to learn and skills to develop in dealing with a host of issues beyond the situation in Ukraine. I just think it's an opportunity for the evolution of global functioning that is being forced upon us that we would never take voluntarily. You know, they're saying that the world is acting in a way that is unprecedented and an unprecedentedly rapid rate in response to this situation. So the opportunities and the dangers are equally high.
Yeah, Pam made the comment, yes, Marvin, the coordination that is trying to evolve globally right now because of this dire threat. And it's very sad that, you know, we have to have this dire threat. But in a way, our little world, such as it is, with no real spiritual government that we see in here, you know what I mean? We don't have our Adam and Eve. We just don't have what other worlds have. We can't turn to the great wise universal leader to say, now what do we do? You know,
right.
We have to figure all of these things out ourselves. So of course it will come down to this dire threat that will bring us to the brink of a decision that is all important.
Yes.
And the decision is the realization that if we work together, there's probably not a single problem we face that we can't
solve. Exactly. Yeah. And we either survive or we perish together.
Right. And that's the lesson, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the choice.
It really boils down to that. Not only survive, but thrive, actually. We can only do that now in coordination globally. That's the magnitude of what's facing us.
Well, I know Andre must be perking because he shared a personal story on the board about his mother and grandmother. And Andre, you've said, you know, you've mentioned that you feel like you can't really be non-biased. Because it's so close to home for you. But what are your thoughts on this section?
Well, the main thing that strikes me from this section is are those six particular lists of what we must, the dangers we must avoid from what they call then budding industry. Well, industry isn't budding anymore. It's full flourishing.
That's
and
true.
I would say that all six of these have come about, though we have seen a turnaround in some sectors from the threat of standardized industrial slavery. We just have been going through the Great Resignation, which is all about.
Isn't that the truth?
I am not going to be an industrial slave for the millennials and Gen Z. They're saying,
mm-hmm.
"Who are you?" They're completely rejecting it. Whereas my generation thought they were going to go through society and their work life much as their parents had. The tables were turned, and by the time baby boomers were about to have seniority, that seniority, that whole idea of seniority went away, and youth started to, from Gen X and Gen Y, millennials, started to be preferred in positions of management. And it was very interesting. All of a sudden, what? that's part of the evolution that happened. But this idea of labor, that's turning around. But the other five, they're not turning around. Yes, they are to some extent with those same generation. They are not willing to go ahead and simply abandon their values in order to have a job. They're not willing to worship wealth, power necessarily in order to have a job. Although that's still, I would say that in the more, in the corporations that pay well, especially the technology corporations, wealth, power, the golden handcuffs are pretty hard to get out of if you're wanting to, say, raise a family, even with good parental leave policies. It's still hard for someone to say, I'm going to take this time off, and perhaps in my time off things will change around my career within my organization. I mean, everybody knows about how those kinds of politics and economic considerations work. But the vices of luxury, cultural immaturity, the dangers of indolence, service insensitivity. Thankfully, there are some, again, that are seeing the importance of having that service in their life in order to be well-rounded human beings. And then you have the growth of undesirable racial softness. Again, that's being countered somewhat in the younger generations, but it really, not before it really took hold, and we see the rise of obesity and general unfitness in the population, both nutritionally and exercise-wise. So, all very interesting what that's saying, and how you don't need militarism in order to combat that. And we're seeing that in our society, at least in some quarters of the younger generation, not wanting to succumb to that.
I would like to see myself public servants announcements come back. I remember that, you know, we solved a lot of problems between, you know, from the time I was a child until now with pollution and our water, you know, because public service announcements brought this into people's collective understanding. It's like, oh, that is a problem. You know what? I probably shouldn't throw my trash out the car window. You know, I probably shouldn't smoke cigarettes. They're bad for my health. These things, I think, really helped, and the media made it a point to make them available. But for some reason, they've gone away. None of our generation will ever forget, you know, the Indian standing on the bank of the river, the Native American standing there crying, tears running down his face because of the pollution in the river. And it was so powerful, right. None of us will ever forget it. And so I'd really like to see that as a tool to elevate consciousness. The media used for some of its best purposes instead of constantly used as a drumbeat of disaster, you know, to show us how, you know, there are ways that we can solve our problems. Look, here's some very good, you know, thoughts that we can collectively hold. But I agree with you, Andre, about these. I see good signs. Spiritual, number one is, you know, there's still a strong drift toward materialism and spiritual blindness. I don't see that changing. It seems like, you know, but maybe it is. Young people are kind of rejecting dogma and creedal spirituality, and they're more embracing a free form of spirituality. And, you know, it's developing. You see it. It's in the developing stages. The worship of wealth and power, I don't, you know, there's still a lot of value distortion around, you know, where we look at somebody who's a billionaire and say, well, he must be doing something right, you know. And one of the features of materialism, I think, is this idea that a man is most revered for the money he has and a woman most revered for the beauty she possesses. And those are both forms of materialism in my mind. And until we get over that, giving people unearned respect just because they're wealthy or just because they're beautiful, you know, that is not the measure of a human character. We know many, many people get wealthy in unsavory ways. And you know, the beauty of a person is the least of what they are, you know. And just one more thing, the vices of luxury, we saw just recently that they seized this Russian oligarch's yacht, and I think it's worth $600 million. It has the biggest pool on any ship in the world. It has its own beauty shop. I mean, this oligarch built himself a floating city, and that's luxury that's so opulent and so ridiculous, so over the top. There's so many better things that could be done with wealth than that, you know. But interesting that they seized it, you know. I think that happened in Great Britain. So go ahead, Marvin. I'm sorry.
In terms of value propositions, let's take three statements that Jesus made that was part of the gospel, that were expressions, they were value expressions of the gospel. The first is, let he who would be the greatest among you become the servant of all. Right? Here's a principle that says it's a spiritual principle over and against a material principle. Material values basically says, a pure material value basically says, the more I can get for myself, the more powerful and the better off I am.
Right.
And
the more servants
side,
I have, the more people serve me. Right?
The more power I accumulate, the more material excess that I control with this yacht, the more power I have in terms of forcing people to my will, bending people to my will, the better off I am. Right. The spiritual value says exactly the opposite. The more I can help and sustain my fellows and love them and give to them so that they are better off, the greater the treasure is that I have. I am accumulating treasure in heaven by distributing whatever I have for the well-being of those around me, to give of myself, right? And here's the second. So one is, he who would be greatest among you, let him become the servant of all, right? Second statement, it is more blessed to give than to receive.
Mm.
And it's literally true on a spiritual level. It is much more wonderful, it feels so much better to give graciously than to receive.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with receiving graciously, but where the power comes from spiritually is to give, right? And then the last state is, no greater love can a human being have than to give their lives for the welfare of other people, to lose everything, supposedly, because of your love and your devotion to the well-being of other people, right? And spiritually, how great a soul you become by spending yourself entirely for the well-being of the whole. Diametrically opposed values, you know? Someone, I'll forgive my particular, but someone like Putin or others who are self-aggrandizing, who accumulate power and think they are the greatest and the smartest and the most wonderful at the expense of other people, are the most spiritually impoverished by that set of values. They're down at the bottom. And all these things will be rectified. You know, I've had, I don't know about you guys, I've had many thoughts. I think about when a war like this unfolds, and people go and say, I am fighting for the well-being of my people and I will lay down my life. I'm willing to die in support of the betterment of my children and my grandchildren's future. I want them to be free. And they go and they die, right? They pay the ultimate price, the ultimate sacrifice for the welfare of others, right? They are spiritually great. They have accumulated tremendous spiritual capital, and they will forthwith be resurrected, you know, on the higher world, and pick up the forward momentum, while those who have accumulated vast power through unscrupulous means and violence and selfishness and self-aggrandizement, who are coming right up to the edge of a fall because of their great pride, right? These are the people that will be left low, and may not survive. But if they survive, they will have a huge amount of territory to make up and to undo in terms of learning and growth. And the person who was least in the next worlds will be first. And the person who was first and accumulated power ruthlessly will be at the back of the line and basically will be told, you have a lot to learn, buddy. You better start or else you're in danger of extinction. That's what's really going on here. So, the brave and courageous individual who fights for the freedom of their people and for the future welfare of their children and grandchildren, these are spiritual heroes. And they will conquer. If not in this life, in the next life, that's what Jesus said. You killed me, you crucified me, I rose, and you who thought you were great are laid low. So pay attention to what's unfolding here spiritually. And that is happening. In people's lives right now on this world.
What are the three again? You gave us one that you gave us. He would be greatest among you. Let him be server of all. And then it is more blessed to give than to receive. And what was the other one?
And the third one is no greater love can a person have than to lay down their lives for their fellows.
Then he would lay down his life, right.
And that's what Jesus did.
Right. Well, some things are worth dying for. What is the essence of that statement? That statement is that some things are worth dying for.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting how we give ourselves to things that aren't worth it. There's a great commercial on right now where I'm trying to think of the name of the actor, and I can't think of his name. He's wonderful, though, and he says, you know, will at the end of our lives, will we regret the things we didn't buy or the places we didn't go?
Right.
And I love that because when we invest in our experience, when we invest in, say, something like travel so that we can see the world and see how other people live and learn from them and get to know them and even fall in love with them, which is what's happened to me. Every time I've traveled anywhere in the world, I fall in love with the people of that place. And I learn that they're no different than anybody. They want the same things. And I fall in love with their culture. I fall in love with them. And that all happens because I travel to where they are. And that is a greater value to me. The experience of getting to know people is greater than the experience of having things. And his point is, will you want a flatter TV? Will you want a more powerful smartphone? Or will you regret the things, the places you didn't go?
Yeah, and here's a fourth one, lay up in heaven the treasures that are real. That's exactly what you're speaking of, you know? Those friendships, those relationships where you give of yourself, those are the treasures that last.
Yes. And you have to believe in, you know, I mean, when you think of your treasures in heaven, what are they? What do you get to take? If you believe that life goes on, you get to take your experience. You get to, no one can take that away from anybody. Mm-hmm. What they've experienced in life is a true possession, a treasure. You get to take your loving relationships. Wow, what a blessing those are. And they go on.
You know,
those are your treasures.
I love you know, humor sometimes really manages to grasp things and convey them so wonderfully. There are two sort of little jokes I'll share with you guys that I love that epitomize what we're talking about. One is the famous comedian Jack Benny. You remember Jack Benny?
Oh, gosh,
And he was so good at poking fun at himself in a teaching way, but humorously. So one of the funny vignettes is he's on stage. This was part of his very early TV show. It was a vignette in his TV show. And he had this guy dressed up as a robber with a mask that comes up behind him and sticks a toy, you know, toy gun in his back. And he says, the robber says, "Your money or your life?" And there's a long pause, and Jack Benny looks around, he's rolling his eyes, and the robber says, come on, your money or your life? And Benny rolls his eyes and he says, I'm thinking.
He was hysterical. Didn't have to say anything to be funny.
Right. And then the second one is the story of these three accountants, right? They're money managers. And one of them passes away suddenly, and a few days later, the two of them are at breakfast, and they're talking about their friend who passed away. And one says to the other, well, what did he leave behind? And the other one says, everything.
Everything.
It's like from a material level, you know, he accumulated so much and he left it all behind. He has nothing anymore wherever he is, right? And from the spiritual level, All of what's unnecessary is left behind, and what you've accumulated is spiritual treasure. And that's really who you are and what you've lived and the grace with which you've lived. That's what you take with you.
And that's what people remember about you. And I love to point this out to people. You want to get in touch with what your own values are? Think of the last funeral you went to and what you had to say about the person who was gone. Think
exactly.
About what you want people to say about you when you're gone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you want them to say, wow, she was such a snappy dresser? Or do you want them to say, she was kind, loving, gracious, wonderful, friendly? You know, do you want them to say, oh, he had the greatest car and the best house? Or do you want them to say, he was a great father. He was so strong and, you know, and paternal and loving and giving and kind, nurturing. What a wonderful man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are our values. We get in touch with them, though, only when they're gone. It's interesting. We need to, I think, more proactively look for them in each other now and appreciate them now. And point them out. My friend Mohini says she loves to point out when somebody is being good and kind and generous. She'll say, wow, I like that. You just gave that man your, you know. And someone at the grocery store gives someone a dollar if they're short. And she takes that moment to say, good for you. Thank you for being kind and generous. You know, she points it out. and applauds it. And I think that's a very simple way to hold up a value. Point it out. Say, I appreciate that. That's good. You know, I feel your comment about, you know, a person who's willing to lay down their life, to me that is by definition a hero. You know, it's not heroic to be willing to die that other people might die. It's heroic to be willing to die that other people might live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the definition of a hero. Someone who rushes in where danger is because they think they might save a life. It's interesting how instinctive that becomes in some people. Policemen come to mind. Firemen come to mind. Soldiers, too, you know, willing to lay their life on the line for something that they perceive as of greater value than even their own life. Hmm. And I think truth is one of those things. Jesus was willing to die for the truth, right? The Sanhedrin would have let him live if he'd have just shut up and went away. But he didn't. He kept telling the truth. And, you know, but because why? Because the truth is liberating and the truth lifts us up. And what was the truth he was saying? You are the children of God. God loves you. You know, God loves you as much as anybody. There is no sacred priesthood that God holds above you. You have God within you. Learn to feel his presence. You know, understand that you're brothers and sisters of this one great and glorious God that sent me to show this to you. His message was not troubling, but it was to those who wanted to hold on to their power over people.
Yeah, that's exactly what was playing out, you know.
Yeah.
Because what he allowed the scribes and Pharisees to do is to wield material power over his physical existence.
Yeah.
In essence, what he said, and this is how I understand his act in going into Jerusalem knowingly and willingly to be subjected to their evil and their iniquity, and really what he was doing is he was very, very strategic. He knew. And he built it over 4 years, the momentum. He knew that going into Jerusalem on that Passover, where there would be a million visitors from all around that the civilized part of the world there, you know, except from the Far East, a million visitors that would be there for that Passover week and then would immediately go out, fan out over the entire empire, Roman Empire, with what had happened. There was no broadcasting. There was no internet.
Hmm.
He knew that if he shared it through his magnanimity, through giving up his life and resurrecting and showing the power of spiritual values over material realities, over death, right? He knew that in one powerful lesson, he could illustrate the values of the gospel and have them spread to the entire civilized world, except for the Far East. But even eventually, with one act, he could do that and benefit vast numbers of humanity in the immediate catapulting of his teachings to the civilized world. And in order to do that most powerfully, he would need to give up his material existence and yet conquer spiritually, material reality by resurrecting. And he chose voluntarily to do that because it was the most powerful gift, the way he lived and the way he surrendered to evil and the way he triumphed afterwards was the most valuable gift he could give to our world and to all of his eventually 10 million worlds. And so he gave up his material life in order to share spiritual riches with the largest number of people he could. So that's the nature of the choice, as I understand it. It was
a great giving
choice. Yeah.
I just love that. And it reminds me of this marvelous quote that he spoke after he resurrected and as he was leaving to ascend, he told his friends in paper 181, section 1, paragraph 5, he said, "And now, as I am about to leave you, I would speak words of comfort. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I make these gifts not as the world gives, by measure. I give each of you all you will receive. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be fearful. I have overcome the world, and in me you shall all triumph through faith. I have warned you that the Son of Man will be killed, but I assure you I will come back before I go to the Father, even though it will be only for a little while. And after I have ascended to the Father, I will surely send a new teacher to be with you and to abide in your very hearts. And when you see all this come to pass, be not dismayed, but rather believe, inasmuch as you knew it all beforehand. I have loved you with a great affection, and I would not leave you, but it is the Father's will. My hour has come." I have to correct myself. He didn't say this after he died. He said it before. But the point that struck me, Marvin, as you were talking, is you said, "I have overcome the world." Let's imagine what it felt like for him. That was his own private hell, a nuclear holocaust on him, the way he was treated. And you have to realize what lengths humanity will go to kill an idea and to kill a truth. And the more powerful the idea is, the more dire will be their response to it to try to kill it. But to your point, they can't. They can't. They will not win. You can't kill the spirit within man. You can't. It's not possible. The human spirit will persevere and, just as Jesus said, will triumph through faith. It's like he said, "I have overcome the world, and in me you shall all triumph through faith." He overcame it, and so can we.
That's it, exactly. You know, it's the difference between an evanescent, apparent, short-term victory, right? You look like you're powerful, right? But it's fleeting, right? It's the difference between that and an abiding, long-term, and eternal victory, right? The least shall be made the first, right? The lowest who love and serve shall become the greatest, right? So this business of what looks like power is an illusion. It's an illusion of materialism and the self-vaunted pride, right? It's a smoke and mirrors. It's materialism, smoke and
there's
mirrors.
There's no substance there. There's nothing real there that can last.
It has no lasting value, right? The scribes and Pharisees that thought they won on the night of the crucifixion, woke up in 3 days' time. They woke up and realized their troubles had just begun, because they had built their building on shifting sand. There was nothing there of any lasting value. It was just evil and iniquity. And the truths of the master's life and his mission, those are what abided. And the same thing is true as it's unfolding in our world today. It looks like power and victory, but it's sham and illusion. It's illusory. It's transient, and it will disappear. And the values that are true and real will survive and triumph, right? And the Ukrainian people, with their courage and their heroism in the face, it's David and Goliath, right? They will triumph eventually, and the self-glorification and the raw grab for power will fail, because it has no spiritual substance to it, you know. So these things are playing out, and the world is looking and learning lessons, I think.
Valuable, and invaluable.
Yeah.
Well, Andre, you've been very quiet again.
No. I've just been muted here, and you've been... If you'd heard everything that I was saying, my goodness, but no, I haven't. I've just been following the conversation. I think it's very important that we pay attention both to that, the long term, you know, spiritual wisdom that might be gained from this kind of thing, but looking as well at the some of the tactical moves that we need to make in order to ensure that there is transitional breakdown. And that's the part that I'm a little concerned about, is in the short term, that we backslide or have destructive episodes that been averted had we thought through things a little more wisely. And, you know, right now it's not clear. It's not clear that we are dealing with all the ramifications. To the point that was made earlier, you know, about Taiwan, it may be true that the Chinese government is weighing things very carefully about what is going on, but it is not a given their expansionist tendencies in the South China Sea, that they're not considering what they might be able to get away with given the paralysis that is apparent. That aside, the people of Taiwan are very concerned. And that came out in a Washington Post article just yesterday about it may be that nobody's overreacting in government, but at the same time, people are paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine because they have a sleeping giant just across, you know, the straits, to their west. And
do you think what's behind all of this is fear? Just plain good old fashioned fear. Fear of losing.
Oh, absolutely.
Your culture.
Yeah,
fear of losing your way of life.
Yeah, it's fear playing out on the national stage. It's fear. What's always been interesting to me as a phenomenon is that whatever progress certain individuals have been able to make within society, when you look at larger and larger aggregations of society, they take much longer to come along to that point. In the same way that the Urantia book mentions that while murder has been outlawed for a long time, settling disputes by killing people en masse for nations has not fallen into disrepute.
Yeah.
War has not fallen into disrepute yet. So the same thing is true with regard to people's forward-looking. To the extent that individuals have overcome fear and that there are many who move ahead very progressively, there are still masses of humanity that when we behave en masse as an aggregate, ultimately we behave like primitive human beings. The fear is the most important consideration. It's the most important consideration right now in what we're doing. I mean, it's a reasoned fear, not unreasoned.
Right.
Assured destruction is a real possibility. However, making that a prime consideration for what we're doing and being unwilling to respond to a situation for exactly what it is. Like, for instance, the question would be, are there other ways that we could be taking the assault? Is this not truly just a delayed assault on Western civilization? Does anybody really believe that Putin is not going to find a way to attack the West, even if it's not so overt as to occasion a direct response? We've already seen that there's been a cyber attack on the Ukraine. There may be cyber attacks being planned on the U.S. Is there a value to us learning that an imminent attack is the same as an attack, just delayed in time? and that proactivity is sometimes justified. In the same way that they suggest that proactively going after crime on some planets is the way things are done. That they, when they see things about to happen, they nip things in the bud. It's a very interesting problem, and part of the problem in our civilization is that in the U.S. we put such a high premium on the value of individual rights as dissociated from individual responsibility that any effort to make the individual or society more responsible always receives pushback in our society. And frankly, the political forces on both sides of the equation are afraid to venture there lest they give their opponents something to go after them with. So yes, the short answer is yes, there's a lot of fear involved.
A tremendous amount, yeah. Fear of loss, fear of losing something that, you know. And Pam made this point on
and
the board. She
no
said
courage.
That we have vaccines.
Therefore, lack of courage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Lack of courage, right. And to do what it takes, you know, to sometimes it costs a lot, like even your life, you know. But, hey, more higher prices at the gas pump, well, they would be worth it, you know. But Pam says, have we backslidden too much at this point to avoid the interregnum? And that's I wanted to throw that out to you guys because that's a good statement. Have we? Is it possible that we can avoid it?
That's a really interesting one. I would just weigh in briefly before Marvin and just say the answer is I don't think we've avoided some kind of interregnum. The question is, to what level might we backslide? It's like, you know, if I fall off the cliff, did I fall, you know, 15 feet onto a ledge that's beneath me? Or did I fall all the way into the Grand Canyon? I don't think we need to fall all the way into the Grand Canyon, but it's clear that this already is somewhat of a fall. We don't have enough in place to prevent us falling to the point where already probably, I mean, we don't have numbers, but probably thousands of people have died in Ukraine, at least 1,000 probably by now.
Yeah.
We know that including the Russians themselves, there probably have been. So let me pause and let Marvin or yourself weigh in.
So I think we're at a very interesting juncture really a critical and intriguing and very portentous juncture right now. You have a situation where you have one of the three one of the three major powers, right? There's the United States / Europe, NATO. That's one power block. There's Russia and its spheres of influence. That's the second power block. And you have China and its spheres of influence. That's the third power block. These are the three major nuclear and industrial giants of the world, right? You have one of them, Russia, acting with great hubris and pride, and we know that pride goes before a fall, and acting unilaterally, violently and brutally to subjugate a neighboring democratically elected country and conquer them, right? And what is happening on the rest of the leadership? The rest of the leadership, led really by the United States, but with Europe's coordination, and then coordinating the rest of the civilized world, is acting economically and industrially, not through militarism, right? Look at their section we read, to coordinate at an unprecedented level to isolate that, quote, rogue nation, even though it's one of the great three, to isolate and oppose them. And make no mistake, there is a battle unfolding. It's being addressed industrially. And I think with the marshaling of really higher spiritual values, that basically says the welfare of the whole must triumph over the singular well-being of an individual state, right? Meaning mm-hmm. Russia trying to enhance mm-hmm. its influence. And what it's doing, and this is what's so unprecedented, it has developed a level of coordination industrially to fight the militarism that the Russians are displaying. And I could be wrong, but mark my words, within about 6 months to a year, and this is calculated, the mm-hmm. free world knows what it's doing. Within mm-hmm. 6 months to a year, you will see the Russian economy and society and mechanisms of functioning retreat into the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They will not have the microchips, the all of what international trade provides for a modern mechanized society to continue to function. It's already cratering. Their stock market, mm-hmm. their economy is cratering. Their inflation is up at 20 and 30% almost immediately. People are fleeing the country. They're desperately trying to get their resources out. And what will happen very rapidly, a modern mechanized army, meaning naval, air force, and ground mm-hmm. troops, cannot function without the industrial input of trade that brings in all of the components for the military to function mm-hmm. and continue to function. Mm-hmm. They may have the gasoline, but their equipment is going to fall apart very rapidly, and they have no way of replacing it. Within 6 months, this great military machine will be rubble because it's going to fall in on itself. It's already starting to happen. And what will have been accomplished in hindsight is that a global, peaceful, industrially coordinated reaction on the part of the majority of the world toward a rogue state will conquer that state despite its militarism.
And maybe that will be the birth of world representative government.
Exactly. In the next 4 or 5 years, what the world will have learned is war is no longer necessary. When the world community, by consensus, marshals its industrial weapons to decimate a rogue nation, it will succeed. And that's what the world will have learned, and it will be a critical development in the march toward globalization of our society. That's what I think is going on, and I think the angels are hard at work helping it to happen.
I absolutely agree with you, and that's best case outcomes, I think, Marvin, in this terrible situation. And somebody that I heard comment, that was Thomas Friedman, said, "This is like an honor killing." This was so relevant to me, being a woman, I have to say. He said, "This is like an honor killing. Russia is saying to Ukraine, you fell in love with the wrong man.
Yeah,
and now I'm
exactly.
going to come and pummel you and beat the crap out of you and drag you home."
Right.
And it really is that visceral and that emotional.
Yes,
you know, honestly,
I agree.
It's Putin is operating from that place of baseness where there's complete
yeah.
disregard to what that might do to the children, what that might do to the family, what that might do to the world.
Yeah.
He just,
and here's,
you know,
to carry the analogy further, but what is going on is this is a large family with 10 members, let's say. And one of the members is doing that to its sibling, right?
Right.
And the family as a whole is challenged with how to deal with it. They
yep.
look on in horror. And the family as a whole marshals the capability to take the one bad actor, put them in the basement, lock the door until they famish and are forced into submission and learn the lesson of their mistake. And the rest of the world community goes on. That's what I think is going on. I don't think Russia will prevail. In the short term, it will humiliate and decimate the errant bride, so to speak. You know, in the very short intermediate term, everything will a new way of dealing with it will have emerged. I think they're going to be laid low. I think pride goes before a fall, and I think they will be, as a nation and as their leadership, everyone will learn the lesson that this way of proceeding, the way Hitler proceeded, and the way all the great brutal Stalin, the great brutal dictator, proceeded, is no longer viable in today's world. I think that's what's happening here. Yeah.
And the prayer is, of course, coming from this very base place, there's no reasoning with someone in that space, right? We're not going to win the battle of reason with this person. And this person has his hand on the nuclear trigger.
Yeah,
so the prayer is, please,
power.
Don't let him pull that trigger. Whatever it takes, universe. If you're going to step in, if you've intervened, what, as the time these papers were written, they'd intervened, what, 33 times, Andre, or something like that? Let this be one of the places where you don't allow him to push the nuclear trigger. Don't allow that to happen. And we have, you know, as Andre pointed out early on, we've come close to the brink before, and it hasn't happened. By the grace and ministry of those who love us so dearly and love our world, the sentimental shrine of all of Nebadon, you know, pray that they won't let that happen, that we will have a chance to do exactly what you just said, Marvin, and make this our universal lesson, that we reject this notion of brute force as a way to solve problems. We're done with it. We're going to move on from here. We're going to love our family, this little planet that we're all a part of. And we don't have to pay that terrible price of the destruction of our planet, our beautiful home, you know, to prove someone's point, whatever it is.
Well, or even parts of our planet, because this is not likely to be, you know, full planetary destruction. I don't think it's going to get to that point. The idea of even limited, a limited amount. I mean, how unacceptable is it for the Ukraine to be paying the price for essentially Western intransigence on some of these issues? We have been complacent in terms of really, really safeguarding the world stage. And we even had leaders that were in favor of disbanding some of our activity on how we were behaving on the world stage with our partners for our mutual protection. And now what do we see? You know, we see that actually over time emboldened. This didn't just happen because, you know, somebody's president. This has been happening over time and has been prepared for over the past 8 years since the invasion of Crimea. This was an intention all the way along. So, but I see we're down to our last 2 minutes.
Perry said on the board, "Thy will be done." Yeah, Perry, you got it. You know, we had some point we have to put this over into the capable hands of our loving, unseen friends, who, you know, because we know they're real and we know they're there and we know they're working for our, you know, evolution and our progress.
You know, I think 10 years from now, this period of time with COVID and ecological catastrophes and this war will be looked back upon as a crucial evolutionary stage where many, many things, like they describe in this section, many, many things were able to happen in response to the dangers and the intensity of it that wouldn't have happened in a thousand years, slowly.
That's
evolutionary.
Such a good point.
We were forced to deal and to coordinate globally. So I think
and
even
look at
10
our
years
own
from
culpability.
Now, we're going to look back.
You know, we really are forced to look at our own culpability, like Andre just said, the ways that the places we fell short, the places we might have done better too, you know. And I go back to the last thing that Melchizedek said in this section. He said, old-fashioned war did select an innately great men for leadership, but modern war no longer does this. Boy, don't we see that. To discover leaders, society must now turn to the conquest of peace.
Yeah.
So industry, science, and social achievement. So that's it.
You
guys have got to leave it there.
You look at the model of the two styles of leadership between Putin and Biden in the West, right? One is around, you know, unilateral conquest, and the other is around global coordination. and unity.
Right.
And so, you know,
right.
there are two styles of leadership on trial here. We'll see what prevails.
We'll see which one prevails, yeah. Well,
yeah,
thank you,
yeah.
friends. It was so great. What
yeah.
a great study. We missed Chuck, but he'll be back later. And thanks to all of our listeners. Love you guys. Everyone who will listen on the archive, we think the world of you. We love being here to do this. It's such a great pleasure. So thanks for listening.
Yeah, let's all stay in prayer for the people that are
yeah.
struggling and for
let's
courage
do.
And sustenance, spiritual sustenance.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Send all the angelic troops to Ukraine, please.
Mm.
yeah.
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 Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks,
well,
guys.
Until next
love
time,
it.
Then.
Okay.
Yeah. Bye for now.
Next week. Yeah.
Love you guys.
Bye. Love you too.
Love you too. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.